SEC has approved your Phase 1 mission goals. Your next job will be to recruit and train a team of superpowers. 3 or 4 Sigma superheroes, to be precise. Volunteers who have the right attitude. Supporters of law and order. Which, in this context, means you're going to be overrun by Daily Mail readers who can hurl lightning bolts and grow tentacles. Wait. I must look horrified, because he gives an avuncular little chuckle as he twinkles at me. What sort of fool goes out and buys a Lycra body stocking and cape, then beats up on bank robbers for their jollies? They're not like you and I. Normal for Norfolk, maybe, but not likely to pass our background checks and personality profiling under regular conditions. There are also going to be 3 or 4 Sigma types who are already visible to the public. A certain level of narcissistic personality disorder goes with the territory, as does a predisposition towards authoritarianism, and a naive belief in playing cops and robbers. Charming people. So we need someone to keep them in line, and that someone is you. Oh, hell. I'm doomed. Utterly doomed. His logic is completely unassailably right. We're going to be inundated with numbskulls who have acquired the power to vent their existential rage on a complex multicultural society that they don't understand. We're going to end up with UKIP in a pervert suit. But we're going to have to comply with gender, ethnicity, and disability non-discrimination law. He shakes his head. I'm sorry, but the official Home Office superhero team is going to have to conform to public expectations of what a superhero team should look like. Or it's not really going to work terribly well. There's room for one person of colour, one female or LGBT, and one disability in a core team of 4. If you push it beyond that ratio, it'll lose credibility with the crucial 16 to 24 male target demographic by deviating too far from their expectations. Remember, reasonable people who acquire superpowers are not our target. This is a propaganda operation aimed at the unreasonable ones. Disturbed hero-worshipping nerd bigots who, if they accidentally acquire superpowers, will go on a marked wrecked spree, unless they're held in check by firm guidance and a role model to channel them in less destructive directions. But, you're telling me I'm going to be managing a team of 4 Sigma assholes in capes? How am I supposed to keep them in line? The SE smiles again, and now I realize that he's taking delight in my dismay. That's impossible. No, it isn't, Dr. O'Brien. He sits up and leans towards me, confidingly. You see, I was the one who instructed Emma to send you the people you're talking about. You... what? For the real Home Office superhero team, Dr. O'Brien, the management superhero team. The ones who will stay discreetly in the background and organize the paperwork and the logistics and do all the heavy lifting. While the incorrigibles arrest supervillains and take credit for everything and preen in front of the television cameras. For the real team, who will yank the incorrigibles' choke chain if they get out of hand. The team I've very carefully spent the past month recruiting and assembling for you. He begins raising fingers. First, the Met offered us the use of Officer Friendly, who, as a 4 Sigma superhero in his own right, also happens to be one of the 3 highest-ranking police officers cleared for laundry liaison operations. Abilities? Super strength, flight, night vision, powers of arrest and paperwork, and a master's degree in criminal psychology. We'd be idiots to turn him down, even if they think he's there to keep his line managers fully informed of our activities. He's a perfect fit for the team. Secondly, I asked Blue Hades if we could borrow Ramona Random. She's a retired occult clandestine operations officer and a highly experienced intelligence analyst. She can operate underwater, in which environment she has unparalleled flexibility. You might also have noticed that she is able to project an extremely powerful glamour. She's a rather powerful necromancer as well, thanks to a not dissimilar entanglement process to the one that gifted your husband with the powers of the Eater of Souls. and Blue Hades kindly agreed to loan us and train her in operating. A rather interesting piece of high-technology equipment that will come in handy when you need to move the team around. Think of her as your science backup. He pauses to pick up the bottle of scotch and tips a finger into my glass. Thirdly, we come to Ms. Mary Murphy, who needs no introduction except to say she's a fang, a person of hemophagous anagathic neurodegeneracy, otherwise known as a vampire, complete with super strength, mind control, inability to see herself in mirrors, and a tendency to catch fire in sunlight. The usual, in other words. Yes, she's a blood-sucking fiend, but she's also a superbly competent administrator and has an MBA, which I think you'll agree makes up for a lot of sins. Speaking of which, you do remember that she and your husband were over practically before you met him. High-level managers often have to work with highly competent officers who they do not like, but do so in a professional and even-handed manner. Think of it as a test of your resilience, if you want. And finally, there's you, Doctor. Combat epistemologist. Lecturer in paradimensional harmonic summonings. Highly competent magus. And entangled with, sorry, bearer of, the pale violin. I watch, horrified, as he reaches for the decanter once more. Together, he declares, as he wraps my nerveless fingers around the refilled tumbler. You will fight crime. It is only on my way back to my desk after lunch, the AC insists on taking me to his club for a celebratory meal, that I realize I never got to discuss the vexatious Professor Freudstein and his curious musicological obsession with him. When I finally get back to my office, I am rattled to find Officer Friendly cooling his heels in the lobby, just as Dr. Armstrong promised. He's in mufti, wearing a suit, not a police uniform, but everything about him screams cop. I manage to fake a smile, even though my stomach is leaden and acid indigestion threatens. Good afternoon, Chief Superintendent. Are you a Jim or a James? He rises. Jim is fine. He purrs. We shake hands. His grip is reassuringly solid. I gather you've been in a meeting with the, senior auditor. Dr. Armstrong, yes. He told me to expect you. I hold up a finger. Let's talk in my office. Office furniture conveys relative status. I park myself on my throne, and Jim responds adroitly by moving his seat off to one side so the desk isn't between us. My grand boss put him in touch with me a month ago, he says, sounding utterly unapologetic. He told me not to tip you the wink prematurely. Jesus, how high up does this go? Well, welcome aboard. I guess you're our official police liaison, coming at this from the SS side of the table, I shrug. Where are you desking on the police side? In a porter cabin in the car park round the back of Belgravia Nick. He looks crestfallen. We're ridiculously short on office space in central London these days, since they sold the old yard off because they thought that moving everybody over to hot desking and smartphones would save floor space. On the other hand, all I need on that side is an analyst and a pair of bodies to handle contacts and paperwork until we've got a team ready to deploy. About which... He glances at the doorway expectantly. Yes, that. Wait one. I pick up my phone and make a couple of brief calls. By the time I put the handset down, the first invitee is slipping in the door. Mary, I'd like you to meet Chief Superintendent Jim Gray from the Met. Jim is on secondment to ACPO, and he's going to be our point of contact with the police. You've already met his alter ego. How do you do? Mary shakes hands with Jim and peers into his eyes. They both flinch. Ouch! Charmed. Jim smiles thinly. Mary frowns and tucks her gloved hand behind her. Pleased to meet you too, she says darkly. I try to make sense of this as the door opens and Ramona wheels in. Gang's all here, I announce. Jim, this is Ramona. More introductions. This time nobody tries for a psychic beatdown. If you'd like to grab chairs and gather round.
Yes, well, what's...
Mary's eyes slide towards Jim.
This all about?
We've been set up, I announce cheerily. The culprit confessed, which is the good news.
What kind of setup?
Mary's eyes narrow.
A logical one.
I nod at Officer Friendly. Jim is the final corner of our tent. It's all Dr. Armstrong's fault. He decided to assemble a team without telling its prospective members, which is why I've been looking over my shoulder this whole time. I'm supposed to set strategy. Mary, you're on execution of policy. Ramona, you're in charge of human resources and logistics. And Jim, you're here for liaison and forward intelligence. It was absolutely a setup, but our puppet master believes in giving his proxies enough free will to tangle up their own strings.
Oh, hell.
Mary begins, just as Jim tries to say something.
What?
It's Thursday afternoon, I tell them. So the SA tells me that next Monday HR are going to send round our third wave of recruits. We've got tomorrow to read resumes and filter out the obvious no-hopers. Next week we get to interview the survivors. Our job is to pick four of them and mould them into a public superhero team, complete with uniforms, origin stories, the whole Marvel DC public relations package. I glance round the room. Sort of like us, actually. Only younger, more photogenic, and willing to get beaten up by supervillains on BBC News 24. We just have to handle the paperwork and run the office. Nothing, really. That gets a chuckle. Except from Jim, who has presumably spent so many years collaring miscreants that the joke's worn thin.
Great, says Ramona. That explains the rumbling from HR about a pile of CVs they're going to drop on us this evening.
Can you all clear tomorrow afternoon from your calendars so we can go over them together? I ask.
I've got a meeting at 2 with my divisional commander, says Jim. It's to sign off on the resources I need for this project, so it really can't wait.
But can you be over here by 5? I ask. He hesitates for a moment, then nods.
Great.
Well then, the rest of us will get stuck in beforehand.
And then, well, I was thinking about adjourning for a team-building exercise at 7.
What do you have in mind?
Asks Mary.
Any cuisine we all like, as long as it doesn't include calamari.
I keep an eye on Ramona, but she doesn't even twitch.
I know a decent trattoria that's not far away, Jim volunteers. Want me to make a reservation?
That would be great. I stand. I should have laid in some bubbly for this, shouldn't I? Anyway, here's to teamwork. And for some reason, they all stand, and we end up in some kind of four-way handshake. And for a moment, I have a very odd feeling that an invisible caped figure, larger than any of us, is looming over all our shoulders and nodding its approval.
Chapter 10.
Great pay and benefits. Apply here.
It is Monday afternoon. Jim and I are in my office, interviewing the third job applicant of the day, while Ramona and Mary tackle candidate number 4. It is not looking good.
So, Mr. Human, says Jim, do you have any practical experience of community policing?
The human cowboy snorts bullishly and paws the carpet with one cloven hoof.
Nope,
he grunts. All his replies are monosyllables. I'm not sure he'd recognize a compound noun phrase if it tugged on his tail. He has impressive presence, not to mention gravitas. It's hard not to when you're 2.5 meters tall, have the head of a bull, and your horns leave grooves in the ceiling tiles. But he's not going to go down a storm with interviewers. To be honest, he's not going down a storm with us either. But at least he doesn't have a disqualifying prior unspent criminal conviction like applicant number 1. And the less said about applicant number 2, the better.
Any experience of dealing with law enforcement issues at all? Jim asks, overly optimistically in my opinion.
Moo! Nope!
So, what led you to apply for a job as a police auxiliary? Jim coaxes. Can you tell us what influenced your decision to respond to our advertisement?
Job centre in Buzzlingthorpe said they cut my bennies if I didn't.
Coming from the human cowboy, this is a Shakespearean soliloquy. But it's not exactly the answer either of us were hoping for. Jim's forehead wrinkles. Is that the only reason?
They said you'd give us a flying combine harvester.
He stares at us with bovine patience.
Is that true?
Yes, well, Jim sighs. Maybe not. I glance back at the skills matrix on my tablet. The human cowboy is super strong and has an amazing sense of smell. Unfortunately, his IQ seems to be off the scale in the wrong direction. And there's nothing here about his educational attainments. Nothing. As if they've been redacted. Mr. Human, the CV we were sent is missing a few details. Can you tell me which school you attended? What grades you left with? Any other educational qualifications?
Nope.
He shuffles uneasily from side to side, as if the question disturbs him. Why not?
Don't remember.
Why don't you remember? Jim asks quietly.
Was before the accident.
Oh. I share a glance with Jim. Thank you very much for coming here, Mr. Human, I tell him. We'll be sure to tell the job centre you attended the interview, and we'll be in touch within a week to let you know how you did and to reimburse your travel expenses. After all, he did come all the way from a farm in North Yorkshire by megabus just for this. I feel obscurely guilty. We stand up, and I let Jim do the handshaking thing and show him out the door because, frankly, minotaurs scare me. Well, that went well, I say as Jim shuts the door, exercising my real superpower, vinegar dry sarcasm.
Indeed, he sighs. File under mostly harmless.
Poor bastard is probably unemployable. He's barely able to speak in grammatically formed sentences. What was the accident, I wonder? Was he bitten by a radioactive cow? Not our department. But I knew letting HR publish a job advertisement and send it around every job centre in the country was a bad idea. Trust us, said Emma. I glance at the next CV on my screen. Getting burned out. We've got 15 minutes until the next one arrives. Break for coffee? Interviewing applicants for an ill-defined job with no obvious career progression ladder that doesn't exist yet turns out to be a logistical nightmare, not to mention giving me headaches. I can see it's even beginning to get to Jim, who is used to dealing with bottom-dwelling criminal minds on a daily basis. I think this was definitely a mistake, I tell him over coffee. I know that as a non-secret organisation, operating as part of the regular civil service, we're required to advertise all postings publicly and interview all applicants who meet the requirements, regardless of background. But we're getting spammed senseless by recruitment agencies and the job centres are using us as a soft touch for giving their no-hope clients the interviews they need to keep their job seekers' allowance. I realise I'm trailing off, blowing mental smoke rings. Jim is watching me expectantly. If we don't get anywhere in the next 2 days, I think we ought to take a leaf from the SA's book. Send out some discreet targeted invitations.
I thought you'd already done that, he says.
You... I stare. Oh, hell.
Should I?
He shrugs. For what it's worth, I think we're wasting our time interviewing random superpowers. Well, apart from building a dossier of new and exciting antisocial personality disorders, but we don't need to do that in person, do we? Why don't you delegate, Mo? Grab a couple of bods from HR and a couple of analysts. Get Mary to supervise and let them do the donkey work. It's invaluable research, making our future surveillance targets come to us for a job interview. And you never know. If we accidentally trip over someone who isn't completely dysfunctional, we can even give them a job. You're right, A knot in my stomach that I've barely been aware of relaxes. Hell, we could even invite Freudstein, couldn't we? But seriously, let's start at the top and work down. Who was that guy who rescued the woman who drove her car into an overflowing river the other day? We ought to look him up. Proactively identify the good citizens, filter out the ones with criminal records, and see if they're willing to play ball. Shove all this messing around with no-hopers on to... My phone bleeps. Damn. Nick's candidate is due in 5 minutes. I blow on my coffee. Too late to cancel at this point. At least he's the last for today. Want to go over his CV? Jim picks up his tablet. His brows furrow. Candidate number 4, age 22. Name, Fabian Everyman. Assumed superhero alias, The Mandate. School, attended Eton College, took 5 A-levels, at Grey Day Stars. University, Oxford, Brasenose College. Graduated with a distinguished first in philosophy, politics, and economics. Also, member of the Oxford Union Debating Society team captain. His frown deepens. Something in my subconscious is ringing alarm bells. That's not a superhero CV. That's a parliamentary... My phone trills. Yes? It's the front desk. Righto, send him up. I look at Jim. Would you mind escorting Mr. Everyman from the lift? I've got a bad feeling about this one. Jim murmurs. Me too. Wait one. I've taken to wearing a basic laundry issue protective ward all the time, but I pull open my desk drawer. There, nestled in foam inserts, are a pair of heavy-duty bracelet wards, beside a tube of extremely unusual mascara. I pass Jim a bracelet. Wear this, I suggest. I clasp the other one around my left wrist, then tap the mascara tube against the edge of my desk, hoping it hasn't dried up completely. Pale grease, trademark, bright eyes, registered. Products have been off the market for years. But in the course of wrapping up the Billington corporate empire, we seized some of the more exotic ingredients. And if life hands your research department lemons and a recipe, you shouldn't be surprised if they make lemonade for you. Or better still, anti-lemonade countermeasures. The mascara turns out to be dry and crumbly with age. I manage to mess up one eye before I hear Jim's heavy tread again. Damn. I wipe it off as best I can. Put the brush back in the tube, and the tube in my jacket pocket, and I'm blinking irritably when the office door opens. Jim enters, followed by candidate number 4. How to describe the mandate. We asked all our applicants to change into character for their interview. They can use the shower room downstairs if they're too embarrassed to be seen on the street. But the mandate could easily have marched up the pavement and in through our front door in his superpower persona without raising any eyebrows. He smiles, teeth gleaming like a toothpaste advert. Dr. O'Brien, I'm so pleased to meet you at last. I've been hearing great things about your work. His handshake is warm, dry, and firm, as a manifesto promise. You too, Chief Superintendent. Marvellous to see you. He makes a superb first impression, but I really couldn't tell you the colour of his eyes. I can't tell you the colour of his skin or his hair either. His suit is impeccably cut. His shirt and tie immaculate. The whole turnout just a millisecond behind the leading edge of current fashion. He wears discreet cufflinks and mirror-polished Oxfords. He has a carefully rolled-up copy of The Times tucked under his left arm. Have a seat. I smile instinctively. Jim sits next to me, closer than normal. Is he nervous? So, Mr. Everyman, you do understand that we're not a constituency party selection committee. We're actually recruiting for a superhero team who will work for the Home Office. What talents can you bring to the table? He smiles, and it's so contagious that I find myself grinning back at him involuntarily. Well, you see, he says with boyish enthusiasm.
I can run it for you. From the top, that is. I know we're still 15 months from the next election, but I'm going to be the next Home Secretary.
He chuckles at his own joke. And it's so funny Jim and I join in too, although I have a distracting shooting pain in my left wrist.
That's my ability, you see. I have unshakable faith in myself, and if I believe in something, everyone around me has to believe it too.
I nod along. That's a very useful ability.
And I believe that, tomorrow belongs to me.
He smiles and whistles a familiar melody. Cabaret.
Wonderful, Jim says with feeling. But what about your other powers? Oh, I don't need any.
The mandate's smile widens. I realize that he's absolutely correct. If you can make the people around you believe whatever you believe, why would you need super strength or the ability to fly? He'll be a wonderful Home Secretary right up until he graduates to Prime Minister.
I can make bank robbers hand themselves in and volunteer to return their ill-gotten goods. I can make orphans laugh, and I can make wife-beaters beg their victims for mercy. If I was so inclined, I could sell you bridges that don't exist. I can, and will, bring peace to the Middle East. I can even do a Tony Blair impression.
He has Jim in stitches with that one.
It's true.
He's got the charismatic former Prime Minister's mannerisms down perfectly. Only he's better, more convincing. I struggle to keep track of my interview checklist. I seem to have mild heartburn. No, my silly necklace is just overheating. I'm about to reach up and unfasten it, but the pain in my left wrist has turned into a burning itch like nettle rash, spreading halfway to my elbow. I rub it with my right hand and feel an unfamiliar restraint that seems to pulse in time with my heart.
Why do you want to work with her?
His smile disappears, replaced by a tiny frown of concern.
Oh, I don't want to work with you, Dr. O'Brien. I'm sorry, you seem to be labouring under a misapprehension. I'm here because I want you to work for me.
I nod, encouraging him to continue with his explanation, even though I'm squirming in my seat, driven half mad by the nagging itch in my left wrist.
Excuse me, I finally burst out. Need to powder my nose. Urgently. Back in a minute. Take your time, the mandate says indulgently. I'd be very grateful if you could fetch me a coffee on your way back. White. 2 sugars.
I scurry towards the door and dash for the ladies. I lean over the sink for a minute, gasping and trying not to throw up as I run my left wrist under the cold tap. The red welt left by the high-powered defensive ward on the bracelet begins to fade.
Damn, that was close.
I shudder, skin crawling, and force myself to breathe slowly and deeply. I've seen heavy-duty glamours in action before, but that was something else. I try to remember his face, but there's just a smear of skin between hairline and chin. A vacant mask onto which it is altogether too tempting to project the kindly caring features of an identikit best friend. Hairline? I can't remember. Then I realise he's still in the room with Jim and my violin case is parked under the desk and I swear softly. I pull out the mascara tube and carefully brush more of it onto my lashes. It's crumbly and rubbish and as it moistens it begins to run. I'm going to have horrible raccoon eyes this evening. But I have a compact mirror, and I manage to get some of it to stick where it belongs. It stings a little, but when I finish blinking, everything is bleak and crystal clear. I put the tube away, pull out my phone, and call Mary's office line.
Yes, I'm in with a candidate.
We have trouble, I interrupt. Jim's in my office, and we've got a problem. Our candidate has a glamour level 6 or higher, maybe even an 8. It's a full-blown, you-gotta-believe-me field, and I need backup to get the bastard out of the building. Put your candidate on hold and meet me at the front desk right now. Over. I put the phone back in my pocket and head for the front. Mary arrives a moment later, followed by Ramona. They seem to have caught my sense of urgency.
What?
Asks Ramona, looking up from her wheelchair. I offer her the mascara tube.
Is this what I think it is?
I nod. Mary shakes her head.
Level 6 or higher, you say?
She takes my left wrist, and I suppress a violent flinch as she touches the bracelet.
Like that'll do you a lot of good.
She tries to look me in the eye.
Mo, stop that. Don't freak out on me now. Listen, are the blinds in your office down?
I swallow. Yes. I breathe deeply, trying to center myself again. He sneaked in under the radar, and he's got Jim's undivided attention, and worse, my violin's inaccessible. Under my desk. Ramona pauses in the middle of applying the brush to her lashes.
Ooh,
sharing mascara brushes, part of me thinks. But it's not as if we've got spares. That stuff is worth at least 3 times its weight in gold, and they're not going to be manufacturing any more of it once the supply of ingredients runs out.
You should be safe from him with this, she says. It's pretty potent stuff.
Right.
Mary taps her toes, waiting for Ramona to pass her the makeup tube.
So, you want to get him out of the premises as fast as possible? Do you want him to leave via the window or the lift shaft?
I think he'll go willingly if he realizes we can see through him, I say. The big problem is Jim. If he decides to stand his ground and tells Officer Friendly to neutralize us. Ramona glances at Mary, who is now working on her own eyes. Our clumpy lashes make us look like a failed goth revival.
Right. So that's what we plan for. How about you and I distract Jim while you,
she's looking at me,
go in, avoid engaging the target, retrieve your violin and order him to leave. If he doesn't leave, then we tackle him.
Wait one, says Mary.
She hands me the mascara. Then she disappears. I mean, she literally disappears. She dashes back towards her windowless cubbyhole of an office so fast that I can't track her. A couple of seconds later, she comes screeching back, all but leaving scorch marks on the carpet.
You'll need these,
she says, offering us a small translucent box. What? I focus on it. Earplugs? Good thinking. Why does Mary keep silicone earplugs in her office? Ramona takes the box, extracts a pair and passes it to me. I have second thoughts and pass it back to Mary. Plugs will get in the way of me deploying Lecter. You need these more than I do, I tell her. Then I beckon. Follow me. It all goes down in a matter of seconds. I open my office door and march directly to my desk. Mary follows at my left shoulder, and Ramona wheels in behind her and zigzags to clear the doorway. I pay no attention to the 2 sapient cauliflowers from Arcturus, but instead bend down, pick up my violin case, press the eject stud, and bring my instrument to bear on Fabian Everyman in 1 fluid movement. Freeze, I say, glaring at him along the fretboard. Lecter hums under my fingertips. He seems edgy, even nervous. Mr. Everyman turns to look at me, and with my pale grace, trademark, enhanced vision, and my defensive wards cranked up to 11, I see him for what he is. The fine hairs on the back of my neck rise, and I burst out in a cold sweat, as Mary and Ramona grab Jim and pull him out of the firing line, shoving him towards the door with go-go-go urgency.
Well, this is a surprise, says the mandate.
He grins widely. I'm not sure which is more disturbing. The gaping jaws, crammed with pointy carnivorous ivory. The red-rimmed eyes, or the scaly green skin.
I really didn't think you had it in you, Dr. O'Brien. May I congratulate?
This interview is terminated, I announce. I draw my bow lightly across a string that shimmers as it vibrates, bringing a note into being,
that is so pure that it threatens to rip apart reality. Firmly.
Your application is rejected with prejudice. You will leave this building right now and never return. You have 10 seconds to comply.
My target raises his arms in surrender. Arms that end in green-skinned webbed hands, their fingers tipped with claws. I tense, nerving myself for the next note in the killing symphony, but he seems to mean it.
As you insist, I will depart peacefully. There's absolutely no need to be nasty about this, but please, I urge you, don't say anything you might regret after the next election.
His smile gapes wider, but thanks to the Bathory trademark brand mascara, I'm immune to his charms. I track him, alert, bow at the ready.
Which party is going to select you as a candidate?
I demand as he stands and turns to leave.
Not that it matters, but I want to know who to vote against.
Which party?
The lizard man spears me a saturnine grin from the doorway.
It doesn't really matter. I'll be running for whichever party wins the election.
Toodlepip, dear girl.
I expect to see you in my office sooner or later.
Late morning, the day after. We're having a post-mortem on the interviews and have reached a consensus that none of the applicants are even remotely suitable. Mary and Ramona have just finished swearing about their last exploding clown car of an interview with TV channel-changing boy. He can fast-forward through advertising intermissions by snapping his fingers and pointing at the TiVo, crack the DRM on Blu-ray discs by squinting at them, and he's the Federation Against Copyright Theft's worst nightmare. Home office superhero candidate, not so much.
Definitely no more interviews with open applications,
Mary complains.
We had 7 meetings with highly dysfunctional no-hopers and 1 plausible nightmare that was entirely too close for comfort.
Jim sits, hunched and uncharacteristically quiet.
Indeed, he says thoughtfully. That was a teachable moment. Was he applying to be a superhero or a supervillain?
Ramona asks plaintively.
It depends on whether he fills out his parliamentary expenses form, right?
Damn. We're definitely going to have to keep tabs on him. I have a feeling there was something else inside the lizard skin. I stop, convinced I'm jumping at shadows, but Ramona picks up on it.
Yes, I think so too, she says. The super politician front with a level 7 glamour is just a cover. The first secret identity. When you got him to drop it, the lizard man wasn't his real identity either. There was something even deeper going on. I wouldn't rule out the possibility that it's onion skins all the way down. Just a vacuum wearing an empty suit.
Jim speaks up.
I think we may have just met our first genuine 5 Sigma superpower. The question of whether he's a superhero or supervillain is at that level strictly irrelevant.
Irrelevant why?
Mary crosses her arms. Jim leans back. He looks almost bored.
Crime isn't always black and white. It's easy enough to finger petty criminals, but the high-level ones get really complicated. Was the 2007 financial crisis a crime?
Certainly. There were criminal actions involved.
It flushed out Mr. Madoff's pyramid scheme, for example. Over £10 billion were stolen, but that was just the ripple on the surface, as trillions of dollars of derivatives evaporated when the market lost confidence in their existence. Were those losses criminal? Were the naked short sellers who gambled against the market and undermined confidence in it criminals? Or was something else going on? Sometimes bad stuff, crimes even, happen, but there's nobody to blame. And sometimes you get people who commit criminal acts for what they consider to be good moral reasons.
I don't think... Mary begins,
and I'm about to interrupt because I don't want to get derailed into an argument over fraud between our supercop and our former investment banker. But Jim rolls over her.
Criminology, he announces, is the study of criminal behaviour and criminal psychology. But it has an Achilles heel.
Good grief. A cop who uses classical references and expects his audience to follow him.
insofar as we can only study the criminals who, through happenstance or stupidity, manage to get themselves arrested. Designated or self-proclaimed supervillains are idiots. They're damaged narcissistic personalities acting out their needy cravings in the public gaze. They're creating the spectacle of the absurd. Warholian junkies searching for their 15 minutes of fame. Supervillain teams are even worse. They get locked into groupthink and end up with the same failure modes as the homicidal maniacs who fly packed airliners into skyscrapers. But those are just the ones we know about. Suddenly, Miri focuses on him like a guided missile that's just locked onto a target.
Like vampire elders,
she says thoughtfully. Jim looks puzzled.
Elders?
Let me tell you the first law of vampire school.
She stands up and paces across the office, to stand against the wall, daringly close to the window blinds.
The first law of vampire school is, if I can tell you're a vampire, I must kill you. Because if I can tell, the sheeple, no offence, that's how the elders think of you, might also notice, and institute national noonday naked roll calls or something.
She frowns at Jim.
Functional supervillains would be like vampire elders, staying out of the limelight, maybe even finding ways to dispose of the narcissists who risk drawing public wrath down upon the superpowered. Yes?
Possibly.
He looks pensive. But there are supercriminals. I'm sorry, that's unclear. I don't mean criminals with superpowers, I mean criminals who overachieve spectacularly and get away with it. They're so successful that they pass laws to legitimize their past actions. We don't call them criminals, we call them the Prime Minister of Italy, or the President of the Russian Federation. Treason doth never prosper, what's the reason? For if it prosper, none dare call it treason. Add superpowers to that kind of supercriminal, and they could plausibly go where you're pointing.
He looks up at Miri.
But the Mandate isn't a supervillain. He's not damaged enough. He's something worse. I sigh, and shove a stray wisp of hair out of the way. I'm going to get Sam and Nick to open a file on him, I tell them. I also need to seek advice from legal, maybe even the DPP. We need guidance on how to handle political cases. The blowback could be immense if we start monitoring a candidate and it turns out he isn't guilty of anything. But this bears further investigation, just in case we've got a 2-meter-tall flesh-eating lizard running for Parliament.
I really wouldn't take the reptile face seriously,
Ramona chips in. Her smile is acid. He's riffing off David Icke, the whole lizard royal family conspiracy thing. It's a double blind to make everyone who sniffs him out to look like a crank. I don't know for sure what he is, but you can be certain the truth will be much, much worse. I start to shove my hair back into shape again, but end up clutching my forehead. A half-breed mermaid sent by the Deep Ones is telling me not to worry about shape-shifting lizards disguised as politicians. And a chief superintendent is telling me that there's an entire category of criminal he can't collar because they're so successful they end up running the country? What next? Mary grimaces, baring her canines.
Which brings me to the next topic. I need you to follow up the requests for Nick and Sam to get access to Temporamo. It's been 4 days, and we haven't heard back from CESG. And Jim, these PNC and SIS login authorizations you offer to sort out are becoming an urgent priority. Without those information systems, they're not really able to pull their weight. Once they've got access, I'd like to requisition at least 2 more analysts. We're going to need bodies to build up a general database of known 3 Sigma and up superpowers. And more bodies to weed out potential employment candidates and, from the other end, persons of interest to monitor. If we can get those authorizations sorted out by tomorrow, they should be rolling out reports by the back end of next week.
My smartphone vibrates for attention and I grab it. It's Dr. Armstrong's office line. Oh dear, this can't be good.
Yes,
I say.
trouble, he says crisply. You can expect a major incident call to reach you within half an hour. Assemble your team. You're going to have to deploy prematurely and at short notice.
Wait, what?
Can't stay. Got to run.
He hangs up on me. Meanwhile, Jim is answering his phone.
Yes. Yes, I see, sir. Can you repeat that?
He pulls out a pocket notebook and begins to scribble furiously in it.
Yes, certainly, yes, we can do that.
Give me your number.
More scribbling.
All right, on our way. I'll call you back once we're mobile. He hangs up. That was the Assistant Chief Constable for Greater Manchester. The GMP have got a major incident developing, and they want our help right now.
Well, fuck. We don't even have a proper superhero team to deploy. Just a bunch of managers suffering from post-traumatic interview syndrome.
What can you do? I ask Jim. He stands up.
I'd better suit up. Be right back. Don't go anywhere without me.
I pick up Lecter and glance at the other two. I know Jim can fly, I see. But what about the rest of us?
Leave it to me, says Ramona. Meet me in the sub-basement car park in 10 minutes. I've got to file a flight plan first.
Chapter 11. Battle Without Honor or Humanity. The SE said that Blue Hades have entrusted Ramona with some sort of exotic high-tech transportation device. But silly me. I wasn't expecting a stealth, supersonic vertical takeoff submarine fueled by the eerily whistling ghosts of necromantically murdered dolphins. I take the lift down to the basement with Ramona and Mary, where we find a near-featureless blue-black lozenge squatting on the concrete floor of the car park. It looms out of the shadows, and I see that its top nearly touches the ceiling. There's no obvious way for it to have gotten in here. As we approach, I get an unaccountable conviction that it's bigger on the inside than the outside. Also, that bits of it change shape whenever I look away. But the real problem I have is that I walk through this garage daily on my way to violin practice in the storeroom, and I've never seen this thing in here before. The implications of its subtle presence are as disquieting as the SA's office window vista. Ramona drives her wheelchair up to the side of the darkling hull and touches it. An oval orifice dilates, rim pulling back like a squid siphon.
"Follow me," she says cheerily. "To the fishmobile!"
A short tunnel leads towards a cramped passenger compartment, fitted with not entirely humanoid seats, at the front of the vehicle. There's some sort of glass cockpit affair at the apex of the narrowing compartment, a wraparound glassy curve that pulses with a dim glow. Ramona drives straight into it and parks her chair in the niche. Four clusters of short tentacles sprout from the floor and twine around her wheels.
"Make yourselves at home and strap in," she says over her shoulder. "We're just waiting for Jim now."
"The window."
Mary sounds as tense as I feel.
"Relax. It isn't glass. It's a projection of what the hull sensors can see, down-sampled and filtered to block out blind fire or basilisk attacks. It won't burn you if your sunblock is compromised."
I look around nervously. The seats look as if they came out of a stealth fighter cockpit design exercise by H.R. Geiger. Clearly they share an aesthetic with their office furniture suppliers. I secure my violin in a storage bin against the wall beside my own chair, then sit down and try to work out the intricate 5-point restraint system. Mary slides into the seat beside me, clips herself in, then takes a mask out of her handbag and pulls it on.
"Like it?"
she asks. Behind us, Officer Friendly climbs into his chair, fully suited up. It creaks under his armoured weight. The hatch contracts, and my ears pop very slightly. I'm watching Ramona over the back of her chair. She's stroking and squeezing some disquietingly biomorphic controls. I hesitate to call them knobs or a joystick. The boy's own Freudian symbolism, with which aviation technology is freighted, is bad enough as it is. But the way they change shape and pulse as she fondles them is truly disturbing. A hatch in the ceiling above her opens and a helmet drops down, dangling from a fat umbilical tentacle. I'll swear it has suckers. She pulls it down over her head.
What do you think of...
Mary says then.
Oh!
We begin to move. The motion is fluid and silent at first, utterly unlike any vehicle I've ever been in before, except for a brief hovercraft trip in my childhood, and that was tooth-rattlingly noisy. We glide forward, between the concrete pillars of the car park, then turn smoothly towards the exit ramp. Faint, ghostly whistles and pops accompany every change of direction. The hair on the back of my neck feels abruptly cold, and my ward burns against my skin. This is necromancy, but not the sort that starts with the destruction of human souls. Some other sapient species, a person, but not in human skin, was sacrificed and bound to power the engine behind us. It twists the computational geometry of space-time around this capsule so that it changes position. Entropy, information, and energy are all interconvertible sides of the same multidimensional coinage. One paid for in blood and agony. I shudder as Ramona drives her eerie vehicle up the exit ramp, pauses to check for cross traffic, then turns into a street leading to Essex Road. From the outside, we look just like a white Mercedes Sprinter van, she tells us. Same bounding box, same physics model, all simulated. In reality, we're sitting inside a quasi-biological construct powered by necromantic information decay in a pocket universe. But try not to let that get to you. I look at Mary, at a loss for mundane conversational gambits with which to defy the eerie twist to her reality. Nice mask, I say after a while. She nods, expressionless. I can't tell if she's pleased. That's probably the idea. Her face is concealed by a white lacquered shell, with mirror glass inserts where the eyes belong, and a pair of tiny silver fangs protruding from the ruby-painted upper lip. She's bonded it to the front of a black silk balaclava, the neck of which is tucked inside the high collar of her blouse. With her black trouser suit and gloves, her skin is completely covered, protecting her from the lethal radiation of the Daystar. And she actually looks, well, I'm not sure how to describe her. Scary is such an inadequate word, don't you think? I thought if we were actually expected to kick ass in person, we ought to look the part. So you can call me... She pauses for dramatic effect. White Mask. You know, that's actually quite a good name. I agree. And pull my smartphone out to make a note of her alias. First law of vampire school, she reminds me. What's your creation story going to be? It's an origin story. And I haven't thought of one yet. The truth is far too banal. What do you think Ramona should... Ramona steers us onto the northbound carriageway of the A1 and hits the gas. Or piles further torments upon the undead souls of the slaughtered porpoises, or whatever it takes to cause us to accelerate. We gather speed. I try to ignore the high-pitched whistling and sonar ticks as Mary thinks about my question. Ramona's a fucking mermaid, Mo. All she has to do is drop her regular glamour, and nobody will recognise her. That leaves Jim and you. Don't look round, says Jim. So I look round.
I said not to look,
Officer Friendly says reproachfully. He's changed into a somewhat more compact version of his armour. The Riot Van Friendly version. His face is invisible behind the mirrored visor of his helmet, and the blue light at its pointy apex is dimmed, pulsing like a sleeping laptop. As for the rest,
It looks as if someone commissioned Stark Enterprises to design power-assisted battle armor for Judge Dredd. Or maybe it's just the Territorial Support Group's new model riot gear.
Right, I say faintly.
Don't worry, Mary reassures me. You can just be scary violin lady. True enough, that pigeon's already flown, and taken a crap all over Trafalgar Square in front of the BBC News 24 cameras. I'm worried about our lack of forward intelligence, I start to say, when Ramona interrupts.
Going invisible, in 3, 2, 1, now, she announces. And going vertical, now.
The undead cetacean ghosts scream in existential agony as our vehicle tips back and shudders very slightly. Then a couple of virtual MEs of acceleration land heavily on my lap. I hope she knows what she's doing and cleared restricted airspace before she pulled that stunt. It would be worse than embarrassing to trigger an air prox investigation. London is slap-bang in the middle of some of the densest air traffic in the world, and the Civil Aviation Authority is a sister agency of ours. The shuddering diminishes slightly. The roar of wind just beyond the edge of the hull rises, and the sky outside the knot windows slowly darkens as the metropolis drops away beneath us.
Above flight level 600, we're out of controlled airspace, our pilot explains. There's nothing to butt heads with except drones and the odd RAF Typhoon, and we can outrun them all. Please tell me you're not going to go supersonic.
Too late.
She sounds smug.
Shit. The paperwork's all yours then.
The moaning and clicking from the ghost engine behind us is threatening to give me a headache. I can feel Lecter stirring in his case, irritated and disturbed. Last time the RAF scrambled to intercept an airliner, they broke windows across three counties.
Relax. We're way too high for that. All they're here is distant summer thunder. Beginning descent and deceleration in 6 minutes.
6 minutes?
But Manchester is nearly 300 kilometres north of London.
I glance around the interior of the shiny trade bauble that Blue Hades have loaned us, along with a chauffeur to put it through its paces. Then I think back to the diplomatic reception on the oil platform in the North Sea.
Right.
I'm just a woman from a tribe of Neolithic dugout canoe builders being given her first ride in an outboard motorboat. Maybe there is a message here. Perhaps Blue Hades simply thought we were getting slightly too cocky and needed a low-key reminder of who owns 75% of our planet's surface area.
I'm not getting a sat phone signal.
Officer Friendly speaks through a voice filter. It lends him a robotic, slightly menacing tone.
Can't punch radio waves through the plasma sheath while we're hypersonic. Don't worry, we'll be down at street level again in just a few minutes.
Ramona sounds distracted. What are we walking into? I ask, trying to keep a lid on my anxiety. We're cut off from base. Our analysts don't have full access to the police national computer network anyway, and we didn't have time for a full briefing after what happened at the library. I'm feeling very twitchy. Jim, what do you know?
The deputy chief said it was kicking off in Oldham. It started with a previously scheduled EDL demonstration and an anti-fascist action counter demo. Nothing unusual, but it brewed up larger than expected, then turned ugly. Then the major incident kicked off. Confirmed superpower involvement. Officers injured. Extensive property damage. Civilian demonstrators injured. An ambulance crew hurt and their vehicle destroyed.
Shit, says Mary.
My thought exactly. Jim continues.
We need more intel. We can't go in blind in a situation like this. We could easily make things much worse. So the first thing to do is to go find the incident commander and get briefed.
Yes, absolutely. I agree. Ramona, we need to set down somewhere so we can get a sit rep. How long?
I'm hauling arse to get us there as fast as I can, she says just slightly reproachfully. I can land us within a mile of Oldham Centre.
Hmm.
There's a good-looking football ground not far from there, and it's a weekday, so the car park shouldn't be full. Oh, God. I can just see the headlines.